This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Rich. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With David Canfield.
Hi.
And Rebecca Ford.
Hi.
On this week's episode, we've got the somewhat unexpected comeback of the Hollywood Foreign Press and next week's Golden Globe nominations announcement. We've got more discussion of West Side Story and Nightmare Alley, which we discussed a bit last week. We've got Don't Look Up and Being the Ricardos, which have their review embargoes lifted now. And we talk about the New York Film Critics Circle and the National Board of Review Awards, both of which were announced last week and kind of kicked off a new round of award speculation. And then finally, at the end of the episode, you'll hear two interviews. First, we have David Canfield talking to Anjanou Ellis about her role in King Richard. And then Rebecca Ford talks to Belfast director Kenneth Branagh. So I think surprising all of us, we are talking about the Golden Globe nominations and the press conference announcement that's going to happen next week as we record this. The state of the HFPA and the Golden Globes and whether or not the Globes exist anymore had been kind of an open question until they basically came out and said, hey, we're doing it anyway. And immediately as we record this, they put out a statement on Twitter that was essentially like, we hear you. We want to be better. The president of the HFPA talked to our colleague Joy Press for a piece that she published this week, as well as some publicists who are still pretty skeptical of the group. There's a lot to talk about, and David, you'll be there next Monday for the press conference announcing the award, so we'll have more to talk about next week. But David, just kind of generally, what are you anticipating when these nominations come out despite all odds?
I'm anticipating most people like me going out of sheer curiosity as to the boldness of continuing to hold your nominations conference at an ungodly early hour at the same location as if nothing has changed. And I bet a lot of people do show up for the sheer spectacle of it. You know, my feelings about their nominations this year is that they're going to play it as safe as humanly possible, as safe as HFPA possible, I should say. Mm-hmm. Just because this is a year they really need to skate through to regain the prestige and televised spectacle of what they normally are next season. So I'm just hoping for someone to say Dear Evan Hansen at the podium and everyone in the crowd to gasp and cheer. That's all we can hope for, really, because otherwise, what are we doing here?
I mean, Rebecca, you were doing reporting on the Globes over the summer when two of the members kind of quit in frustration about how these reforms were playing out. And now they're saying, you know, we've reformed, we've done it, we're ready to return. Are you surprised by how quickly they're just going for it?
Yeah, you know, I am surprised. I feel like a lot of the people I talked to who had a lot of criticism about this group are also surprised, because it just feels like maybe they should have taken a little more time. Like, maybe they should have taken a year off. And at the same time, a lot of people understand why, because you disappear for a year. It's really, really hard to come back. The memory of everyone who works in Hollywood is so short. But it does feel like, I think it would have been a better move maybe to just sit it out this year. So, you know, and I think in this release, it actually mentioned that three of the studios have not provided screenings or shared their content with voters. So there are some studios that are sticking by their sort of policy to not cooperate this year.
But we don't know which ones those are, right?
We don't yet.
we're digging. And I mean, it's even a question of how much access they have, because in some cases, I saw an Entertainment Weekly report yesterday that some studios have, you know, intentionally not sent links out to these members mm-hmm. and like actively do not want them to see their movies. And so it'll also be interesting to see, is there a movie that you could safely assume they would go for that doesn't pop up a lot? And, you know, there are going to be a lot of rumors flying around that stuff, too, I think.
And you know, I think the question for us and for the media as a whole is how much you cover them. Like, we are obviously, you know, we love awards and we love covering who's been nominated for something. And I think people probably deserve to feel happy if they get nominated for something. But who's going to actually put out a statement thanking them for the nomination? Who's going to, like, cover the list of nominees, just straight face? Like, it's a kind of a test for all of us. And, like, how much are we going to let them kind of come back and get away with saying that it's really ready to make its comeback?
And how much do we want to give the reported 21 new members a chance? You know,
mm-hmm,
like
yeah.
maybe this is a whole different organization now. I just want to preemptively congratulate Dear Evan Hansen on its record-breaking 30 nominations.
I mean, there are a lot of musicals this year. You know, there's, I think we've said this maybe amongst ourselves, maybe on the air, like this would be a really good year for the legitimate Golden Globes to exist, because comedy musical could be a fun category more so than it is in other years. So, you know, maybe I'll feel a little bit thrilled when, like, In the Heights gets some recognition that we didn't feel like it was going to get otherwise, despite all the kind of Sturm und Drang surrounding it.
I was gaming it out with a friend last night about, like, okay, so best actor, musical, or comedy, how many other people have to get nominated, not to keep beating this dead horse, for Ben Platt not to get nominated? Actually, the math is there, like, because, like, DiCaprio for Don't Look Up, like, that is a comedy, you know, like, mm-hmm. I don't know. Devoid of all context, it is kind of an interesting year to think about that, because, like you said, Katie, there have been so many musicals, much more so than a normal year.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's a good way to lead into the next thing I wanted to talk about, which is what we talked about last week. Honestly, Richard, you and I talked about West Side Story. David and Rebecca, you talked about Nightmare Alley. We were all over the place traveling, seeing these movies. Now we have all seen all of them and can kind of regroup and maybe get a little bit more distance from this big rush of hype that happened for both of them. And we've seen some awards for both of them come since then. I mean, just a quick up and down vote. I think we were all highest on West Side Story as an Oscar contender. Do we feel as enthusiastic as we did a week ago about its odds here?
Yes.
Yes.
I do. I feel very enthusiastic about it, both in terms of its chances and just personal feelings about the film, which I really mm-hmm. unexpectedly loved. Yeah, I think it's a really strong contender.
Yeah, I think they really pulled it off. You know, everyone was really doubting how you update this film, and I think they're having more screenings this week with the talent on stage, and you know, it's being met with a lot of standing ovations, and I think they've really done it. So yeah, I'm very high on it as well.
Richard, you are a voter in the New York Film Critics Circle, and you are not at liberty to discuss the voting process, but you guys did give West Side Story an award for cinematography, which surprised me a little bit because there's a lot of really beautifully shot movies. But, you know, speaking generally, like, that does seem to indicate a level of support for this movie among critics, not just, you know, old school Academy voters who love a classic musical.
Oh, yeah. And without getting into specifics, like, West Side Story had a lot of support in other categories as well. You know, nothing that got it to a win, but it was well represented in the many, 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 many rounds of voting over the course of the 5 hours that we were in that room at Lincoln Center, which felt fitting, you know, given mm-hmm. West Side Story's
setting. Were the wrecking balls or the big construction equipment where Riff lives just right outside your window?
Yeah, and then I don't know if people know this who are listening, but after we vote every year, we do a Jerome Robbins dance in the plaza.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
to honor history. But you know, speaking of another group of critics journalists, I actually don't really know who's in the National Board of Review, but but Rachel Zegler won Best Actress at that you know, annual thing, and that for me, none of this syncs up directly with the Academy. Yes, but like, that's a strong show of support for that film. In my experience talking to my colleagues in the critic circle and those who are not, but are in other voting bodies, like, that movie, like you said, Rebecca, like, it kind of surprised people. It was like, wow, they actually did pull it off. And I think that among its many other merits, that kind of like, hey, they did it energy really will help propel it to, I think, a lot of success. And I think the big thing is that I would hopefully, I mean, I would imagine that that's going to be like a big box office-y, like, over the holidays kind of movie. So it'll have like popular support as well, which, yes, the public is not voting for these things. But when they like something, it can help, I think, change the winds for a movie's chances at the Oscars.
Yeah, you imagine the relief of having a box office movie to support at the Oscars. It feels like it's been 100 years since that happened. It hasn't been that long. But I think we were all talking about Dune and being like, well, Hollywood's back and people went to see it, so they want to embrace it. But West Side Story seems like a much more natural fit for that kind of like, the people love it and the Oscars love it. And we'll throw all of our weight behind it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm curious to see what this filmmaker, Steven Spielberg, I think his name is, and what he does after this. You know, this is a huge calling card movie for him, you know.
Yeah, a lot of promise. Several of our listeners, I think maybe after I raved about him last week, were interested in, I have reason to believe it's Mike Feist, not Face. We're going to have to find that out. But he plays Riff in the movie. I thought he was my favorite performance in it. People wanted to know what we thought his odds for a nomination were. I'm pretty high on it, especially because supporting actor has been a little bit of an odd duck this season. Anybody else want to join me in saying he will get nominated?
I don't know, Katie.
No.
I mean, you're right, though, that I can only think of two actors who I could comfortably say are getting nominated there, which are Cody Smith McPhee and Kieran Hines for Belfast. Beyond that,
who both won awards this past week.
Correct. I would have, you know, said that before. Other than that, it is hard to say how this category is taking shape. And I would like to think that he's so good in the movie, and if the movie just completely, you know, knocks voters off and it gets, you know, over 10 nominations, I would like to think he could be a part of that. But, you know, the role isn't Anita, which is a more immediate, like, yes, this is nomination worthy for an actor who's not been nominated before. And you just wonder if name recognition of others or just general seniority of others might bump them out, because it is always harder for younger actors, I think, to find their lane here.
All right, fine. Accept your dose of reality.
But I'm rooting for it.
But speaking of younger actors, do we think that Ziegler is going to, like, has made her way to, like, sort of a sure thing for Best Actress?
Oh, yeah, I think so. More younger male actors.
No, I know. I'm just kind of pivoting, like, because I again, the NBR win for her is big, and I wonder if Ziegler is for sure in, does that mean that someone else gets bumped out, maybe even Gaga? I don't know.
I think she's in. I mean, she feels like that sort of story that, you know, the Oscar seasons have, where it's this, you know, feature debut, amazing performance, and then she lands the nomination.
Lady Gaga model, honestly, from A Star Is Born.
Yes, exactly. And can also sing. It's perfect. Yeah. But I don't know who that knocks out. I mean, that category, I feel like if you've got Stewart, Gaga, probably, right? Coleman, Kidman?
Mm-hmm. I'm the being the Ricardo's pessimist. You can call on me if you'd like.
Yes, I mean, I'm not so sure about Kidman either, but I feel like those seem like the most, I mean, that's five. So I don't know, and like, it feels like it's nearly locked in that group.
Oh, and then you also got, you know, speaking of people making their film debut who can sing, like Alana Haim's floating around over there, Penelope Cruz is floating around. It feels like there's like eight actress possibilities, and you could almost take any combination of them and have a reasonable prediction.
I do think that the person whose chances Ziegler affects most directly is probably Alana Haim. In terms of two actresses making their debuts, it just feels really unlikely to me that both would make it in. And Ziegler feels far more likely, not to say she gave, you know, a dramatically better performance, but it's just so much more neatly up an Oscar voter's lane for what they would go for here for a debut.
Well, on the actress front, though, you guys were a little pessimistic about Mike Feist, but how about Ariana DeBose and or Rita Moreno and or both?
What do you guys think about the differences between the two? It feels like a lot of people that I've seen, a lot of our peers are predicting Rita Moreno, even though they would concede that DeBose gives the richer performance, which is just by nature of the role. But it does feel odd to lean in the direction of she's a legend, even if the role isn't as good and she doesn't have as much to do, she would be more positioned to win. I do think both can get nominated, though.
It does feel like a really cynical way to look at it, being like, well, Ariana DeBose is the big standout. But I mean, and like, with all due respect to Rita Moreno, you know, like, she won an Oscar for that role. Like, she has a reason to be legendary there. I would be thrilled to see them both get in. But you do, I wonder if, like, the campaign, then it's their job to kind of circle the wagons a little bit and figure out how they want to push everybody and what makes the most sense. And everyone's kind of waiting for that to happen.
I think people are really geeking out about the fact that Rita would, mm-hmm. you know, make history being nominated in the film she was in before and all of that. So I feel like, I mean, not everyone is obsessed with, you know, interesting data of awards like we are, but I do think enough people sort of realize how historic that would be, and that obviously helps her with the nomination. But I think it would just be such a shame if they both didn't get in. I mean, I don't even know if we've had two Latinx actresses in this category. I'm going to assume not. I'm just going to assume we haven't ever.
Seems likely.
So, like, and they're both so deserving. I hope they both make it in.
I mean, that's the thing, is that they are both really deserving, you know. And you look at Ariana DeBose, who, like, I don't think that many people are aware of her. I mean, I remember her most vividly from, like, doing the hosting at the pre-Oscars thing.
She was great, though.
And it felt like the Academy being like, well, just wait, Ariana, we'll get to you. You know, like, it felt like they were kind of putting a placeholder there. And then you watch West Side Story, and she, like, not only, like, does Anita well, she, like, really plays it and, like, has a character and adds something new to it with the help of Tony Kushner's script. And you know, I just think that, like, she makes such a declarative sort of statement for herself and for the role in a way that Moreno did when she won the Oscar for it. And then Moreno, you know, they gave her Somewhere. So she gets a big song and she's not just there puttering around in the background as like, hey, look, a living legend. She actually, again, plays a character and, like, has stuff to do and does it well and does it convincingly. And kind of it becomes the moral center of this show. So I think they're kind of both undeniable in the way that, like, you know, two of the actors from The Favorite were, you know, who both got nominated. Like, mm-hmm. I think there's room for them. And it's in a category that we have all had kind of question marks around this whole season thus far, because it's a strange category this year. And there are a lot of great supporting actress performances that, like in Mass or whatever, that probably haven't gained enough steam to get in there. So I think there's plenty of room for both of them, and it would be deserved.
Well, maybe that's my transition to Nightmare Alley, because when that premiered in New York on Wednesday, I think the name that most people talked about immediately from the cast was Cate Blanchett, who kind of emerges in the second half in this very classic femme fatale figure. She dresses great. She has an amazing office. She leans on all manner of furniture. And I'm just kind of poking around Gold Derby, and there's not that many people, like, actively predicting her in the five, although she still feels for me, and David, I think you wrote this in your analysis piece, like the likeliest acting nominee from this group. Should that just leave me to believe that maybe Nightmare Alley isn't an acting contender at all and we should be focusing on it elsewhere? David, what do you think?
I think I said this to Rebecca last week, but it feels equally weird to say that a movie with this cast will not get any nominations, and that given the movie we've seen, that it will get any acting nominations, which is just through a combination of factors. Like, probably my favorite performances in the film are Richard Jenkins and David Strathairn, who just don't, you probably need one or two more scenes to really be competitive there. Cate Blanchett has, like, the meatiest scene, and she gets that back half of the film, which is really completely structured toward her big last scene, and it's a lot of fun. But it's, there's a little bit of coldness to that whole arc that may be difficult for voters to connect to, and really to the whole film. And I just don't know that Bradley Cooper, given that he's not seemingly campaigning much, and that much of that performance is kind of hidden from view until the end, when he really he does have a great last scene, I don't see how he breaks into such a competitive best actor category. So yeah, it feels like to me mostly a crafts play that could conceivably fit into the Best Picture 10. I think it will, just because it is such a beautiful looking movie and the score so great, and I think it'll play well enough. But yeah, I don't know that it is going to get an acting nomination at this point.
It did make the NBR 10, I guess it's 10, you know, the day after it premiered, basically, which felt like a strong vote in its longevity there, that they immediately put it on there.
I'll tell you this, I saw the movie last week, and walked out of it and was like, wait, did I love that? I don't really know. And then I thought about it that night, and I've thought about it since. And it's really that final scene, not with no spoilers attached. I mean, people have read the book, presumably, and so they kind of know where the movie's headed. But, like, I was not familiar with any of the source material. I hadn't seen the movie from, you know, with from the 40s. And so it really came, kind of crept up on me as a surprise. And that final scene is so good, mm-hmm. and Cooper has so much to do in it, mm-hmm. that I feel like a lot of voters could feel the same way I did, which is like, that final scene makes me forget other things I didn't like in this long movie's run. And I feel like that could push him over the top, because it's just like, it is, to use a kind of trite construction, Bradley Cooper like we've never seen him before. At least I don't, mm-hmm. can't remember a role where he did exactly what he does in that scene.
Yeah, I think I've been thinking about his performance like since I saw the movie, and I'll have this experience where I'll think of a scene of this film, and then because the film like goes on such a journey, and the first half is quite different than the second half, my brain has a hard time wrapping around the idea that this was all the same movie, if that mm-hmm. makes any sense.
Yeah, totally.
And so I really respect that, you know, that this movie was so big, and that to me they pulled it off, especially with the ending, and mm-hmm. for me I feel like, you know, a lot of people are going to really, especially the crafts and all that, are going to really admire it. So I also think it gets in for picture, and I think Kate is the one we can't count out, and mm-hmm. could possibly sort of get the acting nom. I do think Bradley is phenomenal and would deserve that spot, as you were saying, Richard, but again, that group is so competitive. I just don't know if he could make it in.
Yeah, Bradley Cooper's streak is just like this incredibly talented, famous, handsome, many nominated actor who can't win. It's just going to continue. He's going to like be reaching Amy Adams status before we know it. But I think I agree with you guys that like this and Licorice Pizza, neither of them seem to be pushing him over the brink this year.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as The Regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after The Regime airs.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Well, we do have a lot of contenders that suddenly we can talk about now that you know, some of us may have seen a long time ago. I actually haven't seen either, so I'll try to talk less. But the review embargo for Don't Look Up is out this week, and it started screening a few weeks ago. It feels like it's been out there a long time. It was honestly funny to me that the review embargo wasn't up. And Richard, I believe you're reviewing it for us. So how is it?
How's my review? I haven't started yet, Katie, so don't get on
Where is your copy, Richard?
I have to do it after this. I don't love the movie. I don't know. I post Vice, I was just like kind of done with Adam McKay. But I was saying this to a friend who had also seen the movie, that like, in its mild defense, Vice, and I kind of like The Big Short, both of those movies were about like anatomy of a thing that happened, you know, be it the Cheney, you know, reign or the financial collapse. And now in his third film in his new era, McKay has turned to lecturing about things that are going to happen. And that is a decidedly, for me anyway, an unwelcome tone. You know, I get the point he's trying to make. But, you know, it's an allegory for climate change and whatnot and other, you know, preventable catastrophes that we seem to hell-bent on not doing anything to prevent. I understand that, but I think that the tone of the movie really doesn't sell that argument, at least as he's making it. And I think the last third of the movie-ish, maybe just last 20 minutes or so of it, and it's a long movie, they work because he starts taking it seriously. But otherwise, I think it's just kind of a mess. That said, everyone in my audience freaked out. Everything I've read about other screenings, people have freaked out. I think that movie is going to get a ton of nominations. Acting, director, picture, screenplay, score. It's Patel, I think. The amount to which I kind of didn't respond to it felt like the amount to which I didn't respond to like Three Billboards, you know? And so I have to kind of listen to that weird metric, you know? So.
David and Rebecca, where are you guys landing on it? You first saw it a while ago. So has it followed the trajectory you expected when you first saw it?
I think we all feel pretty much the same way about the movie itself. And to Richard's point, Vice was not a movie that worked for me. It was not particularly well reviewed, and it was a huge Oscars player. It got a lot of nominations. And I don't think that this movie is too much of a departure from what the last three movies in Adam McKay's filmography have shown. You know, they're not different from what he's done to me, except for exactly what Richard said. It's more forward-looking. But I think it's going to be a big player. It's not my favorite of the season. There are some performances in it that really worked for me and some that didn't. I definitely thought it was much more effective in its dramatic moments than its comedic moments. But a lot of people were laughing in my screening, so what do I know?
Yeah. Yeah, I feel about the same about it. I think this is just one of those films where it'll probably get a lot of nominations. And I know a couple other people are already sort of seeing it as a lock on, and, you know, the top six best picture prediction list. So, to me, I wasn't feeling that way. But then you look at something like Vice and it did so well in nominations and I could see that happening. And again, like Richard was saying, the score is Patel and very, very, very good. And obviously the editing on McKay's films is always phenomenal. And that this has all of that. I do think it's a great excuse for Leo to finally do a campaign and only have to talk about climate change. So he doesn't have to talk about
it. He did it.
He did it. This is what he's always dreamed of. And, you know, I really obviously respect what the message they're trying to get out there, but it is one of those films that the people who are going to see it are probably already believers in this message and trying their best when it comes to climate change. So yeah, it's an interesting one for sure, but I think we're all kind of on the same page with it.
The one thing I will say with a lot of these late breakers, because they are not going to be as well reviewed, there is a specific design to give them these kinds of big splashy screenings where social reactions are allowed in awards analysis, and they get a real bump out of that before reviews drop. Those screenings are always enthusiastic. I remember last year, I mean, there weren't screenings, but when Malcolm and Marie started screening for Netflix and Zendaya had become, for some known pundits, a best picture, a best actress front runner, which always struck me as a little crazy, but this does always happen. I think being the Ricardos, which we can pivot to, is a little bit more in that category. But I think Don't Look Up 2 could prove to maybe be a little bit underwhelming as an Oscar player, only because it's, I think, more of an overt comedy for most of its runtime than McKay's other two Oscar-contending films. So it's just something to watch out for. I'm always a little bit skeptical of those early reactions and the way that, you know, you pack the actors into the room who cheer for every big speech, and that doesn't always translate to a nomination. So yeah, I'm watching that, but I do think in this movie's case, McKay has the track record to indicate it will do well.
Well, let's talk about Being the Ricardos, because that one has given me just an intense whiplash from people like seeing it, not being that into it, to guild screenings, like screaming, clapping at every line. You know, the reports have varied wildly. And I do think there's a pretty steady report that at these big, broad guild screenings, people are really into it. The reviews are out now and are a little bit less enthusiastic. I know a lot of people who are predicting Nicole Kidman to win Best Actress. Richard, I think you're one of them. As I said, I haven't seen this yet, so I cannot make a judgment here, but I honestly can't tell if it's going to get 10 Oscar nominations or zero. Richard, defend yourself.
I mean, I've been trolling you guys a little bit by David and Rebecca, and specifically texting them late at night saying, Nicole Kidman's going to win. I still think she's going to win. Or she has a really good shot, because I think that the parallels between Ricardo's and Don't Look Up, yes, they're coming out around the same time. They're getting those effusive, deliberately programmed screenings. but they both appeal to a certain smugness within the Academy that the Academy really responds to and has historically in the new century responded to. And I think that in terms of the acting and Ricardo's in specific, is that Nicole Kidman transcends that smugness by like giving it her all. I mean, it's an earnest performance in a movie that I feel is actually not that earnest. And and you know, whatever you think about Sorkin dialogue, you know, I know people loathe it. I guiltily am kind of a sucker for it, even if I don't agree with what the dialogue is saying all the time. It's fun to listen to, and Nicole Kidman is so good at delivering it, and that goes a long way. Just as DiCaprio's big network-esque speech in Don't Look Up is going to go a long way. I don't know. I think Kidman is really a really really strong contender, and my sort of prediction about her winning is more based on the fact that I don't know who in the existing field beats what she does in it. It's not my favorite performance of the year by any means, but like, I think she has enough of the component parts needed to tip her into a win.
Yeah, I mean, the film has, I think it may have said this already, but you know, it's about the industry, and there's things like table reads and, you know, stuff that voters love to watch, and it's two iconic actors at the center. I mean, it's got all those ingredients for, you know, a lot of love from the Academy. You know, David and I saw it really early. Some of the effects weren't even finished. I'm planning on re-seeing it now that it's done. But to me, it didn't stand up to so many of the films that we've seen. It's such a wonderful year for film, in my opinion, and I just didn't think this was it. But I don't disagree with Richard saying Nicole could make it in or possibly win. I would appreciate the late night emotional abuse of getting texts about it to slow down.
Sorry,
but you know, there's nothing I like more than thinking about, you know, Nicole Kidman's age and portrayal of Lucy in this movie at midnight. So thank you, Richard, for that.
It wasn't that late.
No, but I thought about it.
It was late for you,
night.
Richard.
Yeah.
I feel like sometimes we don't give the Academy enough credit. I don't know. Not to say that they always make the right choice by any means or the choice that lines up with what critics think, but this just feels like kind of a miss to me out of a Nicole Kidman nomination. And I actually think the whole cast is really rises above the material in this case. I think J.K. Simmons and Nina Arianda are so good in support, and Javier Bardem, rightful controversy around his casting aside, I think it does well opposite Nicole as well. But the movie itself, I don't see it going very far, and I think that hurts Nicole's overall chances in Best Actress, regardless of, which I agree with, I think Kristen Stewart front runner narrative has died down a little bit, let's say, as that movie has screened to a more divisive general reaction, and the movie itself doesn't feel prime for a lot of other nominations. So there is that open question, but I just don't know if this is the movie that would deliver Nicole Kidman her second Oscar. I think that the bones of it are there. She has the big moments. She has the character arc. Aaron Sorkin can always write a great speech for someone, or at least a baity speech, let's say. But ultimately, Aaron Sorkin as a director has not been as much to the Academy's taste as people tend to expect. Molly's Game did not do well with the Oscars. Trial of Chicago 7 seemed like it was created in a lab to win a bunch of Oscars. Mm-hmm. It got 6 nominations and didn't win any of them, including for, you know, its actors. And I think that this one is not going to do as well as Trial of Chicago 7, just given based on the reviews I've seen this morning and what I thought of the movie, candidly. I think there's a lot to recommend about it, but I don't see it going that far as a big broad player. I do think Nicole probably fits into the final 5, but beyond that, I'm not sure.
Ironically enough, I think we could look back just a couple years at another Nicole Kidman movie, which is Bombshell. Nicole Kidman did not get nominated.
That's the one I've been
that.
Thinking of, yeah.
But Charlize Theron and Margot Robbie did, and that didn't get, well, it got a makeup and hairstyling, which Ricardos could also get, and then nothing else. So it was represented at the Oscars, even though, and then that was screened late. It was, you know, very, the screening I went to when you, with a bunch of, you know, media, TV media people in New York was well attended and well received and all that. And then it kind of, it couldn't make it across the finish line. So I think that in your view of things, David, like that is a totally plausible outcome for this movie, where it was, you know, lauded initially and then it quickly dropped. But I still think that there's enough gas in the Kidman tank to take her to something.
And to that point, if you want to talk about supporting candidate in that very shapeless supporting actor category, I feel like J.K. Simmons ticks a lot of boxes with this performance, and he's a past winner, and I would not be surprised to see him figure into that five even pretty easily. I mean, honestly, I'm surprised he was not more at the fore of the discussions around its Oscar prospects, because he seems like someone who the Academy would go for.
Yeah, he walks in, tells these dizzy dames to stop being so dizzy, and then walks off. He does it well, I guess.
He does it well.
Of all the acting categories today, we're talking about Best Actress. I feel like we've gotten into all of them, but Best Actor. But we did get a question from a listener on subtext, kind of seeing, quote unquote, extreme Will Smith fatigue set in. A, do you guys see that? And B, do you think it's worth talking about potential spoilers in this race? Or does he still feel locked to you?
I think you could have said the exact same thing about like Renee Zellweger around this time, and it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. You know, when an early front runner that strong, there's going to be that sentiment, but it doesn't mean that they're any less likely to win, would be my answer.
It was in Barbara Walters' pre-Oscar interview special where Renee Zellweger said that she throws up after sex, right?
No, I mean, it's an established playbook.
I have seen a lot of sentiment online about, like, has Will Smith interviewed himself out of an Oscar? Like, that was his to win. I don't know. But I mean, I certainly feel that fatigue, but that's partly also because I saw the movie months ago now, and I'm due for a King Richard rewatch. But I still think he's ahead, but he's not doing himself any favors.
It's almost like we should record the date today and look every year if this is when the fatigue sets in.
Because
I think almost every year it's in December where we're like, enough of this person if they've been promoting since the fall festivals. And then they're fine. They come back. So, I mean, maybe he'll go away for the holidays and then everyone will be excited when he comes back.
I don't know how to tell someone why we're right about this, but we were all wrong about Chadwick Boseman. You know, like it's so funny when like a front runner is super clear and it does happen and it doesn't. And that's just because we're not psychics, really. But it does. I think it's because no one seems to be emerging as a spoiler with like the power that Anthony Hopkins did, even though we underestimated him. It was like clear he was the other one that people were the most excited about. And that doesn't seem to be happening this year. But it's a tough line to draw.
We're not psychics. We learned what we do. We all learn what we do at a carnival.
It's a spook show.
Toni Collette teaches us.
We're just pretending. I mean, I feel like the narrative changes every year, but that it also stays the same. And like, you know, Smith was my fearless forecast months ago. I'm still feeling that it's a strong thing. I feel a little bit more fearful about that prediction than I had before. But yeah, I think you're right, Rebecca, that the fatigue cycle is pretty reliable. And all we need now is for people to go away for the holidays, come back in the new year. The room has been cleared out a little bit. And then Smith can kind of more perhaps delicately, you know, reignite his campaign because it's been a weird foray thus far. But I think there is still ample time to course correct.
I do think Benedict Cumberbatch is going to win a lot of critics' awards, and I think he may emerge as a clear-ish challenger, especially because Power of the Dog really played well on Netflix. It was viewed a lot more than their other contenders this season, and that movie being popular enough could make a difference. But yeah, I do agree that around this time you have your set front runners and then you just start questioning how sure they really are. I mean, like, I felt pretty confident about Kristen Stewart. I don't feel confident about Kristen Stewart anymore. So in some case, you know, it's hard to know where those feelings are just creating drama where there isn't any and where it really is like, actually, we have no idea. But in this one's case, like, King Richard did disappoint a little bit at the box office. It has been, I think, overtaken in the, you know, quote unquote crowd pleaser department by a late breaker like West Side Story. And so there are things working generally against that movie's campaign that weren't true a month ago. But I think the power of Will Smith's performance remains strong. And I know people in the industry really, really love it and love that movie. And that's what ultimately counts.
Well, this is a good way to loop back to the National Board of Review and the New York Film Critics Circle, which we've mentioned a little bit throughout. Will Smith won at NBR and Benedict Cumberbatch won at New York Film Critics Circle. So maybe that's exactly that that binary you're talking about, David, of Cumberbatch kind of coming on strong as a critical favorite.
Yeah, and I think that David, you're right to point out that it's done well on Netflix, Power of the Dog has. And I think that is, I did not expect that movie to get traction beyond, you know, snooty critics or whatever.
Yeah, me neither.
But it seems to be. I mean, judging by the amount of Bronco Henry jokes I've seen on gay Twitter, I mean, this movie has legs.
Yeah, the Bronco Henry memes, I just didn't see it coming. And I will be sick of it soon, but I'm enjoying it for right now. The thing from the Critics Circle I want to talk about the most, and I think the most surprising and thrilling for people who have seen it, is that Drive My Car is the best film. Richard, you talked about it as having been on your top 10 last week. But did you think that was going to happen? That you guys were going to pull that off?
I did not think that was going to happen. It wasn't even in my master plan. I got a few things that I had hoped to win did actually win, which was exciting. Catherine Hunter for Macbeth. That was really cool, supporting actress. Yeah. But yeah, Drive My Car, I'm not supposed to reveal too much about how the vote works, but we do not vote for Best Picture last. I'll say that. So we kind of knew all day that had won, which was really exciting. And then obviously when it was announced, people were like, oh my God, like, you know, great choice, which is always great to hear. But also there were plenty of people who were like, huh? You know, but I hope that some of the huh factor has been answered by a win like that. You know, that is a movie that can really benefit in America from that kind of attention. And I don't think that by any means that Drive My Car is going to get a Best Picture nomination, but it, you know, it's looks strong for international feature. And if nothing else, though, it hopefully just shines a little more light on a movie and a filmmaker who had two great movies out this year than would otherwise have been. And so, yeah, people should go see it. I think it's still playing in art houses around the country right now. And yeah, I thought that win was really exciting. And, you know, similar to the Academy, it's a very rare film not in English that won Best Picture in our group.
Yeah, it really makes you hope that we see some other curveballs in there. You know, I think looking at something like this and being like, well, it doesn't tell you anything about the Oscars is really not the point. And we are as guilty of that as anybody because we're constantly trying to predict the Oscars. But, you know, having a small critics group where, you know, a few passionate people can really sway the vote, that is the power that you have. And it's really exciting to see it used on a scale like that.
I think us being about half the size of the HFPA makes us doubly relevant, right?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Somehow that math works out. Yeah, mm-hmm.
I think that's true. Anything from the NBR that stuck out to you guys? We talked about Rachel Zegler. We talked about Kieran Hines. I love seeing the breakthrough performance for Alana Haim and Cooper Hoffman together. Like that's a nice pairing. Anything else that popped up for you guys?
Anjanou Ellis. That's a good win.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, puts her firmly in an expected nomination, which is cool. Despite, you know, that movie not doing quite as well as people expected, you know, and people make fun of the NBR sometimes for kind of being like, you know, sort of an older, more like traditional conservative voting body, but putting Licorice Pizza as Best Picture, like that was unexpected for me anyway. And also Paul Thomas Anderson, one director. So if a movie like that is getting support from a group like that, I think that could be an indicator that it has more of an appeal than I maybe thought it did. Cause I saw it more as sort of a niche, like film, Twitter, Letterboxd kind of hit and nothing else, but it's apparently not.
Yeah. It had a really good week.
Yeah, it definitely did. And I also think a hero getting screenplay is also a nice boost for it, because I do think that film's going to play outside of its usual foreign language category.
And the ensemble win for The Harder They Fall. That's a great prize. I think we shouldn't count that movie out for a SAG ensemble nomination. You know, it's a great cast. It was a huge hit on Netflix. You know, it checks a lot of boxes. It's not a conventional awards movie because it's a bloody fun Western. But like, you know, Westerns have gone far in the Oscars before.
Well, Richard, you mentioned Anjanou Ellis for National Board of Review, which thank you for doing the transition for me, because we have an interview with Anjanou Ellis with David. So, David, do you want to tell us what we're going to hear in your conversation?
Sure. For some reasons to be revealed later, I spent a few days with Anjanou in November while she was campaigning for King Richard. And I met her for this interview at the Black Excellence Brunch hosted by Tina Knowles for King Richard, and specifically honoring her. Yeah, we had a really candid conversation here about her path in this industry. This is the first time she's ever been getting Oscar attention. She's a recent Emmy nominee for Lovecraft Country and When They See Us, but she's been, as she puts it, toiling in oblivion for a long time. And, and this is a moment that feels a little bittersweet for her, but she's definitely taking it in.
Let's listen to that conversation with Anjanou Ellis.
I think that the apparatus of Oscar campaigning and what this industry can be a lot of times is, you know, the Academy is still mostly white, and a lot of the things we talk about with Oscars and, you know, the endurance of things like Oscar So White.
Emmy So White.
Yes, yeah. Remains. And so can you talk a little bit about what an event like this means, celebrating this film, which is coming in and really representing actors of color like yourself who are getting major opportunity in this film to be showcased in a way?
Yeah, well, you know, this idea of Black excellence, I like the idea of it. I know that's going to sound simplistic, but, you know, we have sort of had to, because we've been marginalized from these, you know, systems of, you know, what is supposed to be excellent. Mm-hmm. We've sort of had to be our own auditors of excellence. Mm-hmm. And we always have been, you know, but because we have been so, like, brazenly, you know, left out of these awards, you know, I think that what we're trying to do, and I'm sure that what Ms. Knowles is trying to do and so many people are trying to do is, you know, we have to give ourselves our flowers, you know, mm-hmm. And it's important. It's important that we say that we are the measure of our own beauty. We are the measure of our own excellence, even when we don't get nominations from the traditional forms of those kinds of awards.
So broadly, as this film has continued to roll out and you've been making the rounds a little bit, yeah. I've just heard anecdotally about so many people who love this film and love your performance across the industry, across various segments of it. I'm curious what you've heard beyond people involved in the film. Have you heard from people about being touched by this film and your performance? Because I certainly have.
What you heard? I'm kidding. I am kidding. I'm kidding. I make it a point of practice to not read reviews. And to really sort of insulate myself from that, if that makes sense, sure. Right? So, yeah, and so, but you know, stuff seeps through. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear those messages, the good and the bad, you know, whether you want to or not, you know. Even at the gas station, they have, like, the news at the freak, you can't hide from media in this country. So, you know, I hear things. But I think that, you know, for me, when it comes out on, you know, HBO Max mm-hmm. this coming Friday, and my folk will see it, mm-hmm. people I go to church with, yeah. you know, people who I live with in, you know, in my town at home, they'll tell me the truth. Yeah. I'll know then, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've been away from home in Mississippi for a couple weeks now, right? Doing
yeah.
Is it odd to be away? What is it like? Being a little bit away from the industry most of the time, you know, in your day to day life. You come here, talk to people like me, go to brunches like this, and then you go home. Especially with a project like this that people are so excited about. What is that like for you?
It's like a bifurcated self. Like, do you know what I mean? Yeah, it really is like maybe a little Jekyll and Hyde. You know what I'm saying? I just feels like I'm out here. I'm acting in a movie with Will Smith and these amazing young women, and I'm talking to you, and you know, and the rest of my life is nothing like this at all. Like nothing like this at all. Even, you know, I was working in Chicago for, I've been working in Chicago for most of my, and you know, Chicago is a blue collar town.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's gorgeous. It's got that lake, But, you know, it kind of doesn't care about this kind of stuff, you know? And I love that. I love that. So it definitely feels like I'm living two selves right now, you know?
I also think about it in the context of what you told me last week when you said you felt that career turnaround for you happened when you did move back home.
Yes, it did. It did because I was living in New York. I went to NYU. So I did that thing. You go to school at NYU, then you stay at NYU and you try to act, you try to do that, do those things, do all the things, as they say. And I was just flailing there. I had no focus, you know. I was just doing the things that I'm supposed to do because I graduated from acting school. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
But I had nothing driving me, you know? I had nothing driving me. And then I had to go home because I had a family member who was ill and they couldn't live alone anymore. So I moved back to Mississippi, and something changed. Like, something changed. And I just went into overdrive. I went into overdrive professionally. I went into overdrive politically. And I went into overdrive personally because I had to keep this person alive. And so everything around me became, you know, super magnified and super intensified, you know, like it was really survival on every hand. Like if I didn't work, this person who I was taking care of, they wouldn't live. And then I was living in Mississippi, and Mississippi is, you know, a place that doesn't apologize for the Confederacy, or hide it in any sort of way. And that was unconscionable to me and unbearable to me. So that became a part of my fight. So I was fighting for my family member. I was fighting against Confederates. And then I really started fighting for my professional life. And that meant how that expressed itself was that I stopped accepting no. You know, I just would audition and I would audition and I would audition and I would audition. And they'd be like, yeah, we don't know. And then I would audition again and I would send another tape and another tape. And I think I know that that happened when I moved back home and my life really came into focus when I went back to Mississippi.
Yeah. And so now you mentioned this bifurcated self. And I imagine that there is some part of that that is helpful in a way, that you can have that part of you that is home and allowing you to move forward in all these areas of your life, as you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm telling you, I appreciate all of this. This is all so neat. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like I'm getting my hair done. I get my makeup done. I'm in the new house and I'm talking to you. I cannot say that enough, you know? And I just think it's like, it's very, very cool, you know? But I'm telling you, when this is over, I'm getting right back on that road and I'm going back to my life, you know? That it's the part of me that it keeps me sane. It keeps me alive. It really is, because there's so much about, I love the acting part, I love the creative part of this.
Yeah.
Chopping it up with Will Smith on screen or chopping it up with whoever.
Right.
I love that part. But there's so much that's associated with this kind of job that can destroy you.
Yeah.
Because it is, there's no really apparatus of protection.
Yeah.
Right. Like, it is just you. Your face is a failure. Your clothes are a failure. Like, it is just you. It's not like, you know, oh, you didn't play that piano well.
Right.
Oh, what, you know what I mean? It's just you. And you're constantly being judged and, you know, that part of it, it's soul destroying. And I have to protect myself from that.
Yeah. Well, as you're still here for now, one aspect that you've gotten to do a lot is reunite with your cast. And I got to go to one Q&A last week. What has it been like reuniting with everybody? And also, you know, hearing them talk about the film, maybe in a way you didn't get to talk about while you were making it.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because you don't know, you're in the midst of it. And you're not really aware of what someone else's experience of the thing is while you're doing it. Yeah. You're just doing it. So to hear Will say these things, you heard yeah. him, right? You know, and he was talking about like how his character study and how he read a book to prepare.
A serial killer book.
Yeah, it's a serial killer book. And I'm like, yo, I got to get that book, you know? And I was like, I didn't talk to him about any of that, you know? It was such a treat to hear him talk about his process. Like, I'm sitting here for free listening to Will Smith talk about his process for free, you know? So I get such a kick out of that. And then, you know, these young women, Sanaa Sidney and Demi Singleton, who play Venus and Serena so masterfully.
Yeah,
oh, my God. I'm telling you, I know they think that I'm just blowing smoke up their asses. But it was just watching these young women craft their performance every day was just, I learned so much from them. And it looks like they're just having fun with Will Smith on screen, and it's so much more. It's not just that. Everybody cannot do what they do to be so convincing in those roles as they are.
I love watching you and Will talk, particularly about the kitchen scene, and just what do you get from an actor like that? What does that bring to your performance? What does that do for you as an actor?
Yeah, you know, we didn't talk about that scene. We didn't rehearse that scene at all. There were some of the scenes we were able to kind of talk about and work through, but that one was one that we did not at all. Mm-hmm. So we just sort of showed up, and I think we just really, really were working on making sure that the words were right.
Yeah.
That I sounded, and I was talking to Isha Price, Miss Orsine's daughter, Venus and Serena's sister, up until, you know, 30 minutes before we shot it, and was just asking her, you know, tell me what Miss Orsine would say. Tell me how she felt. Mm-hmm. And she was so generous. And I feel she feels the way that I do. And I'm sure, of course, even more so, that her mother has not had a chance to have her say. That she has sort of been literally and figuratively been on the sidelines of this great American sports story. And no one really knew how central she was to it.
Yeah.
You know? And so I felt that scene was my opportunity to tell the world who Miss Orsine Price was. Yeah. Like, that's how important it was to me. And I think Isha felt the same way. And then when I'm in there with Will, you know, he has his position,
right,
you know, from, you know, Mr. Richard's position. And I think, and he said this, and I think this is fair, that at that point we had been Orsine and Richard for so long that we were able to just breathe and just live those words and mean them.
Mm. It's an interesting scene too, because there's a lot about Richard and children from, you know, his life before Orsine, and mistakes he's made that we the audience haven't been made aware of, that kind of flow into the story through what your character is telling him, which again, I'm just fascinated a lot in this movie by what goes unsaid with your character and how there are all these, there are some blanks you have to fill in because yeah. you don't have as much information about her and her side of the story. So what was it like, say in that scene, for example, bringing these things into the, you know, this is big information for the audience that you're providing when you say these things, mm-hmm. But you're also revealing a really core part of your character as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way that the scene was written. It, of course, it just evolved. It had so many, you know, iterations, you know, and there was more about those kids before.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, a little bit. That's a little bit more. Yeah, but we, you know, that didn't stay. But you know, I had that as my background.
You knew. You read.
I knew about those other kids. You know, and Yeah, I think that that says something about what Miss Orsine had decided that she had to make peace with. Her particular kind of peace, because peace doesn't look the same way for everybody.
Yeah.
But the particular kind of peace that she had to make in order to live with this man, you know?
Yeah.
She had to pay. She had to live with decisions that he made before he met her, and how her resolve to do that. Because it could have been, when she found that information out, she could have been like, nah, I'm out. But she chose to stay for whatever reason. I can't speak for her, but yeah. She chose to stay.
Well, we also spoke last week about what this campaign has felt like for you a little bit in terms of what it means. And I wanted to ask about the other side of it. You've said that there's a practical side to a potential Oscar nomination. Can you tell me a little bit more about that, what that means to you?
You know, the reality is, you know, I'm 52 years old. And, you know, I've been acting since I was 25. And I did a lot of that. I did a lot of toiling and oblivion. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, that there's a lot of stuff that never saw the light of day. And I had a lot of heartbreaks, especially in the last, like, maybe five years, where I was so close.
Yeah.
So close to roles that I really, really wanted to do. And then I would lose out, you know, I'm going to be transparent here. I would lose out to actors, of course, who are fantastic and brilliant, but they have those words, those two words after their names. And when producers are making decisions, That's a part of that. That's what goes in the mix of the decision that they make to cast, and making those casting decisions. And it's just, when I say the practical side of it, that's the practical side of it. Think, you know, the last couple years, you know, remarkably, crazily, I've gotten, you know, two of those words, but beside my name, you know, with the Emmys, and I'm so grateful for that. But it makes a difference. It makes a difference. It makes a difference in terms of how people look at you in casting. It makes a difference in terms of how much you get paid. Said the actor straight to the microphone. So, yeah, I mean, you cannot ignore it. You have to, you know, it's two sides of it, right? You can't let it rule you, because these are decisions made by other people. And my job is already done. My job ended in 2020 in December with this movie. And, of course, you know, doing the promotion for it. But it's out of my hands. Those kinds of things are out of my hands. So you can't let that rule you. However, you know, it does make a difference.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Anjanou.
Thank you.
King Richard is now streaming on HBO Max and now in theaters.
The Run Through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that.
We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Rebecca, let's close out the show and hear your conversation with Kenneth Branagh. Like David and Anjanou Ellis, you have gotten to speak to him several times throughout the season. So tell us about this one.
Well, this time was nice because I hadn't spoken to him since the film had premiered and, you know, been released in theaters. So we talked a lot more about what it was like for him emotionally to release this film that is so personal to him. And it was really revealing. You know, he said he felt like he couldn't have made this film, honestly, when his parents were still alive. And it really helped him to sort of think back on this time in his life that he actually said he never really talked to with his parents. So we went deep on this one, and it's always a joy to speak to him, and this was no exception. I'm so excited to welcome Kenneth Branagh, the writer and director of Belfast, onto the podcast today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You know, since we last spoke, Belfast, your film inspired by your own upbringing and set in Northern Ireland in the 1960s, has come out in the U.S. And I know you've been to a number of screenings as it premiered at festivals and such. What has it felt like to see it finally play in front of an audience?
Amazing. Particularly to see how immediate the impact seems to be with people who may not even have heard of Northern Ireland or the Troubles or know much about any of that. But what seems to connect is family, people's recognition of some of the difficult choices in the film that have to be made by the family, and also a kind of empathy or recognition of the moment in the boy's life, our sort of 9-year-old leading character who is at a point where innocence is lost. And in a way, the film is about a moment that registers, we begin to see the last day of his childhood, if you like, and now the beginnings of, the bruising process of becoming an adult and dealing with, which the film again seems to resonate with audiences around the issue of loss, whether it's the loss of a family or a home or an identity or whatever. And then sometimes it's just simple, it's characters they seem to respond to. And I think the most memorable encounter I had was when the credits were playing at the Telluride Film Festival, where we screened it for the first time in front of a big audience, and a woman came up to me in the middle of the credits and leant over to me and tried to speak and couldn't speak. And I noticed that the tears were running down her face. And then eventually she just managed to get out, "I'm a grandmother." And then she walked away. And that was, she reminded me of my own grandmother, who, when lost for words like that, would eventually say, "I'm too full." She said, "Oh, my mother used to say, I'm full up." And this woman was too full. And I don't think her reaction was anything to do with Belfast, the place. It was to do with, our own experience of being a grandmother. And that was very, very meaningful to me.
Wow. I'm curious, you've directed plenty of films, but because this one is so closely tied to your own personal story, did you have more nerves before sort of debuting it to the world?
I didn't think that I did, but it turned out that I did. So to give you the example of that, really, both Jamie Dornan and I, again at Telluride, were... we both knew that we'd had a very profoundly satisfying experience in making the film. And I felt that, in a sense, that was enough for me, that a chance to tell the story the way I... hoped to eventually came up. But we played on whatever it was, the Thursday night, and I think it was that very night that woman came over to me and said, "I'm a grandmother." And then we had a screening very early in the next morning, and when we were coming into Telluride, there was a queue or a line for the movie that stretched all the way out of town, the longest line I've ever seen for anything. And that was already a sign of a certain kind of jungle telegraph that was operating in Telluride. And I looked at Jamie Dornan, and he looked at me. We didn't say anything. Then we got into we were going to do a Q&A afterwards. And before we went on, I said, "Are you all right?" He said, "I'm feeling very emotional." And I said, "Well, so am I." I said, "Why are you feeling that?" And he said, "Well, because, I come from a place called Belfast. I don't know if I'll ever make another film that's called Belfast or about this, thing." He had lost his father just 3 or 4 months previously. I was still... like everybody is sort of processing that. And then, so we go on for the Q&A. The first question he gets asked about is fathers. So he's gone, he's a wreck. And then, the same thing happened to me because we came on, everybody stood up. This was already sort of overwhelming, really. And then, it was part of a sort of a very emotional journey through the early screenings of this film, where one was humbled by how much it spoke to other people who, as I say, often just came up to me to tell me their own stories, to tell me what it had unlocked, to tell me where their family intersected with this. And so I didn't really quite understand how sort of protective of my own family I was, hoping that it would mean something to other people, because ultimately that's what made me make it. If I hadn't thought that the story could speak, you know, a little wider than my own experience, I wouldn't have done it. But I hadn't realized how you know, emotionally sort of charged that experience would be. But I thought I was ready. I wasn't.
Mm. Is there a part of the film that, you know, obviously having edited it and everything, you've seen it a million times in pieces, but is there a part of the film that gets to you or pricks your heart the most when you watch it?
Well, I think it changes around a bit, you know, so, but a lot of it still does. It really does, because I think one of the characteristics of the piece was that we caught something very spontaneous and real in the boy, Jude Hill. We often didn't rehearse. He's a first-time actor, but he's a very smart lad and a very imaginative boy. And so it really feels as though we were also capturing something in Jude's life, which was a first time, which was an exposure to something new. And there's something very touching about that. So I think the genuineness of that vulnerability and that youthfulness is something that always touches me. There's a moment when he lies back in his bed when his father's just said cheerio and it's early morning, and already, you know, earlier in the film there's a scene where he says, overhearing his parents talking about this decision they might or might not make, you're coming back, aren't you? And when we see him in the just... It's summed up for me this sort of moment of what the kid had lost. So the boy we met at the beginning of the film is no longer there. This other thinking, worrying boy is there. It's only something very subtle in his eye, but it's that often gets me. And then the moment, I think, when Jamie Dornan has passed, says to the mother, thank you very much for, you know, you brought them up. You brought them up. It was you, it wasn't me. And so thank you very much. I think that sort of, that very direct, it's quite an unusual sort of thing in a movie for that. And it's particularly in that kind of sort of unreconstructed, male-dominated but female-run matriarchal society, which the women aren't credited for, but, you know, is the fact, is the concrete that absolutely makes it all work. That almost always gets me for the surprise. It almost surprised Jesus Christ, I know it's coming, but it surprises me. It's something I heard my own father say about my mother so many times that it always gets me.
Yeah. Obviously, this is not exactly your childhood story, but it is inspired by a lot of it. And I'm curious, was there anything you kind of wavered about putting into this story that comes from your own upbringing that you weren't quite sure you wanted to include?
I think quite a lot of it, actually. I mean, I couldn't have made it when my parents were around, because I think my father would have been furious for me to mention anything about the tax man. You know, that would have been, he'd have considered that very, very poor form, probably. Although, because I know my father was an honest man, but the building trade in Belfast was a complex thing. And just, you know, let's say there was a misunderstanding that was righted because they paid all this bloody back tax and it cost so much in time and energy. I think, you know, inevitably one, you know, just wondered about whether it was too raw or too exposed in some way. But the truth is that I felt like it was definitely coming from a good place. And that place was really a place of honouring them, honouring my parents and honouring that time and honouring that city and trying to understand with some compassion the ways in which people were doing the best that they could. And the best that they could was sometimes flawed and sometimes, you know, full of errors and mistakes and things. But, you know, I think I felt at the beginning of the pandemic when I was writing this that somehow, I don't know, we all needed to be a little kinder to ourselves. We all needed to appreciate and value, however imperfect, and every family, I suppose, is bound to be, you know, the gifts that we've been given. And the gift that I was given, we were multifarious, really, but there was that period I would call the, you know, of innocence, of a beautiful, not idyllic, but certainly a home of real meaning for me before the violence began. And then after the violence began, I was really the beneficiary of an enormous act of sacrifice on the part of my parents to leave something that defined them, that city, that extended family. And I guess one of the reasons to make the film was also something I didn't really put together till after we finished it, that we had never spoken about it. Never ever spoken about that day that mob came up the street. We never spoke about the 9 months that in which that decision to about whether to leave was considered. And I think it was for two reasons. One, they had to completely commit to this new life. You know, they wanted to make the sacrifice work, as it were. And also, the idea that you would parade your so-called suffering is a very anti-Irish thing. You know, as far as we're concerned, everybody in the world has problems, and they're all usually worse than the ones we've got. And so it's, you know, particularly from the north of Ireland, there's a kind of anti-showiness, you know. The cardinal sin is to get above yourself. Never get above yourself, and which means you can't go on about, oh, my suffering, my trauma, the time that the crowd came down my street. Well, I'm not suggesting we tried to do that with this film, but I think there was a, wherever they are, you know, I'm grateful to have the chance to say, well, I think you did, in these circumstances, we did all do the best we could, and the best we could kind of learn from.
Do you think we can talk about this scene now that it's come out, that's near the end where Mom makes Buddy return the item he has stolen during a riot, essentially? And I think you mentioned when I spoke to you before that that is actually pretty close to something that happened to you.
Yeah, I got caught up in what turned out to be a crowd heading towards a supermarket that was being looted. So the window, the big plate glass window, had been smashed. And I mean, it was a shop known to all of us, to everybody. It was just, we knew the people who ran it, and, you know, but just the volume of people meant that, you know, it was mayhem. Went in, people grabbing ridiculous things, anything, you know. And in the end, when I was, and I was very uneasy about it, but I didn't know what was going on, but I literally couldn't not move in the same direction. You couldn't get, it was a torrent of people. It was a people jam. So I was encouraged to grab something, and I grabbed a massive pack of, household washing powder. I felt somehow that would be useful, at least. I felt that was more selfless than bringing back a family pack of chocolates or something. But I literally couldn't get in the house when I got there, and I explained to my mother what was going on. I mean, I had to move out of the way because she would have taken my head off with the slap she was going to give me. Instead, she didn't. She chased me back down the street, and we ended up back in that supermarket so that I could be forced to return it. And the idea of explaining "thou shalt not steal" was made clear to me. But in slow-mo, almost for the pair of us, when we got there, was this sense of what have we done. We're back in this not just dangerous but this life-threatening situation. It was a big tipping point for an understanding that things had gone so far that anybody, me as a kid in the human physical traffic of it, or my mother in a kind of passionate reaction to it and against it, could just get so caught up that you lose yourself. It was an example that it was possible at that time, the way that situation was developing, for things to become out of control in, or it seemed like almost a matter of seconds, but certainly in ways that took away reason. And even the most would-be civilized people were in there behaving in uncivilized ways.
Yeah, it's an amazing scene. And I could not believe it was pulled from your real life. I thought it was just something you put on the page, though.
No, I mean, what happens, how it's resolved, it becomes something that isn't quite as directly what occurred. But I don't know. I mean, you're now, we've spoken about it. I don't wish to be personal and curious about you. But as you're now a mother, I just wonder whether just there is an innate sense that there are things that you would do now for your child that you wouldn't, you know, that's whatever that is, whatever that bond is, whatever that innate protective thing, if you feel that, you know, is different from the way you might view such things before you had your child.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, I mean, this character is so relatable because of that. You just feel that it's just a natural fire that's inside her and is just going to exist no matter what. So it really captures that very well. I am curious how this experience will influence your future work? What do you take away from getting to make this film that helps guide you forward?
I suppose the freedom that I had to listen to all instincts, we've talked about them in other contexts, you know, the instincts about shooting in black and white, in many other contexts, that would have been, you know, months of lobbying and praying and groveling to have it considered by financiers who would say, you know, it's going to be, you know, your little, you know, you're reducing your audience immediately. But just following one's creative gut instinct about that was I think what I learned. And then the I suppose the process of writing. I mean, although I haven't written that much, I've got plenty of screenplays in bottom drawers. I've had the glory of working with great writers and you know, sitting in rooms with them and talking about how good writing emerges. And I suppose primarily also, which I think is a key to writing, full stop, is I'm a voracious reader and always have been. Really from the moment reading actually, you know, was what when I came to England and it was much more solitary existence and we got much more insular, what I found was reading. I remember buying my first book, five shillings 25 pence, taking home, and my father being appalled. He said, what'd you buy that for? I said, well, I wanted to read. He said, but once you read, it's done. What are you going to do then? I said, I'll put it on a shelf. He said, we've got libraries for that kind of thing. And so, but I would, the bug was bitten. So I think more, definitely more writing, because I suppose the sense of a certain kind of, you know, authorship that is sort of, you know, very particular when, you know, it's your words on the page and, you know, so I think sort of a freedom to follow one's own instincts as assiduously as possible. In bigger, larger budgeted movies, it's a harder task. Maybe it's not the right task anyway, but, you know, you're in a massively and expansively, let us call it, collaborative situation. And sometimes that's a wonderful thing, and sometimes it can be the enemy of a story told with clarity, as, you know, one is sometimes squeezed into worlds of you know, trying to please everybody all the time. It's not possible.
Well, thank you so much for giving me a little bit more of your time. And for listeners who haven't checked it out, please try to go to one of those theaters to see Belfast as soon as you can. Thank you again.
Thanks very much.
That does it for this week's show. You can find us at vanityfair.com and read us writing about all manner of things that we're discussing right now. It's all happening all the time. You can follow us on Twitter at Little Gold Men and on our own. I'm at Katie Rich and Richard.
Rylaws.
And David.
David Canfield 97.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
You can also text us using subtext. Join subtext.com/littlegoldmen or text 213-401-9739. We love hearing from you always. This week's episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for what we'll all be doing when this award season is over goes to Richard Lawson.
We do a Jerome Robbins dance in the plaza.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.